5 minutes past nine on Racing Pulse. When I was a kid and a young scribe in racing, one of the quirky stars of the game was a trainer called Jim Marconi, who had an amazing knack with cheap horses. He had an amazing backstory, and I've about to learn a little bit more about his backstory too, and he had the most beautiful rich Italian accent I think I've ever heard. Sadly, Jim Marconi passed away a couple of days ago, and he would have been 88 today. His son Carlo joins us on Racing Pulse to pay tribute to his wonderful dad. How are you, Carlo?
Oh, g'day, Matt. Yeah, getting through it. You know, it's hard, but you just sort of console yourself with the happy thoughts, and like, he squeezed every ounce out of life. It was a bit of a shame, that he's missed out on a lot of, grandchildren and great-grandchildren time this year. But, everyone had to do their job this year, and, it looks like we've got through it, this state. We've done the best anywhere else in the world.
How did he cope through the COVID period of the last 6 months or so? Where was Jim for the last 6 months or so?
Well, he, built his, his house, overlooking Mornington Harbour, 21 years ago now. Yeah, and he's been living there for, the last 20 years with Mum. Yeah, so it's, looks out over the pier and the ocean. Things were pretty quiet because, all the boats were, you couldn't use. Still plenty of freight ships going past and that.
Well, we'll tell the story because the story begins across the other side of the ocean, really, doesn't it? So many years ago. And he was a racing star, but he obviously the family legend of the Marconi family. And the story of your dad is quite incredible. And we might even go back to the start. I did briefly have a chat to you off air about your dad's life story. And I guessed that it began in Italy because he had such a beautiful, lovely, rich Italian accent. But I wasn't aware of the absolute circumstances of the start of the story. And it involves the German occupation. Mussolini and Hitler were roaming about. And it involves the German occupation of Italy in the 1930s. Was it pre-war?
Yeah, well, he was born in 1932.
Sorry, he was born in 32, yeah, of course.
Yeah, he was born in 32. He lived in a rural area, sort of 10-acre farms. Everyone was very self-sufficient. They grew their own wheat, corn. They had a cow or two, pigs, grapes, tomatoes in summer, they'd preserve everything, a very simple life.
Classic Italian scene, isn't it?
Yeah, and, but, like, my grandfather, they used to call him Jack of all trades. So, you used to have to, know how to fix your machinery, you do it. Yeah, it was very much a, mechanical minded, and you got to remember, it was my grandfather's uncle who was, the electrical engineer that was the first to make a radio.
Right.
Right at the turn of the century.
Wow. So
it's one of those things. He was the one that figured it out first. If it wasn't him, 6 months later, it would have been someone else. But just look up, googly M.O. Marconi and,
Well, there's ingenuity there. So your dad was born in 1932. The war begins in 39 and ends in 45. And he was caught up in that era, wasn't he, when the occupation began from the Germans. Tell us about your dad's experience through the war years.
Yeah, well, it was pretty much unaffected where he was until... he remembers when he was 10 years old, the school shut down, and that was about the time when the war started, it was about 1943, things started to go bad, from the partnership between, Mussolini and Hitler. Anyway, it went from a German partnership or whatever, the Axis, and the Germans became occupiers, started imposing, restrictions on the population. And Dad recalls that there was one of the older kids that was, I think, was accused of vandalising some German infrastructure or something, and he was hiding up in the hills. And because Dad was a little bloke, he was about 11 years old, they used to give him food, you know, and had to sneak out the back paddock and go up the hills and, yeah, leave the food at a designated spot, you know. And, yeah.
To help out. So, you know, help out. Was that his brother, the other kid, or just one of the local kids?
No, just Like, and as things got worse and worse, the fighting got closer as the Americans came up from the south. They used to had unlimited access to ammunition. Like, you remember, they'd pull apart 4-inch shells, you know, to get the, you know, to get the propellant out, and hand grenades. Like, they used to go hunting birds by throwing hand grenades into nests, and the animal. it was pretty gruesome, but, you know, when you're in a situation where human life becomes so cheap, you know, everyone's attitudes, you know, get, you know, warped.
Exactly. Yeah. So the war finished in 45, and then there was a wave of immigration in the 1950s out to Australia. Were the Marconis part of that wave of immigration in the 50s?
Well, he went to work for his uncle straight after the war, who was a builder. You know, he was about 13, 14 years old, and they did everything, a lot of damaged buildings and then electricity transmission lines up in the mountains. He remembers having to, they'd take dynamite up on donkeys and then have to take cement, blow holes in the hills where the surveyors had put the pegs, and then mix concrete and make foundations for the, you know, the big high, you know, transmission line towers.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, he made a fortune. By the age of 23, he was so well off. And as is wont, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but there was a family feud and it was his dad and his uncle or something. And it was so acrimonious, and he remembers his mother asking him, "Jimmy, can you please, you know, can you sort this out?" Because they were so, you know, stubborn, and I'm right. Yeah.
Just sounds like one of them had to leave the country. Is that how this sorts itself out?
Dad just had enough money. He just paid them all out and said, "Yeah, I'm out of here." And he had enough money to... He actually flew in the old Super Constellation. You know, that was, you know, like the equivalent of my generation flying on the Concorde. You know, instead of everyone else was on ships. No, he did it in class on the plane. Came out to Australia, you know, because his brother had actually gone on a working holiday. But Dad had cleaned himself out financially, fixing up the family fight.
Right.
Yeah, and said, "Oh, I'll have a working holiday." Yeah, worked on projects like there was in South Australia. There was doing building infrastructure in Aboriginal settlements, and got a contract. Yeah, so that was his exposure to. Yes.
All right. And then he became a builder and a tiler, and then he sort of ventured into... the curious thing for me, you can tell us about the issue with the tile, with the block out from the tiling industry as well. Yes. But then we'll start talking about his interest in horses as well, because there's nothing in the life story so far. So it was an amazing transition into owning and then training horses. But the issue with the tiling conglomerate that existed at the time?
Yeah. Well, I'll just go back a second. When his first introduction to horses was when he was in South Australia, and some of his mates that he was working with said, "Oh, okay, let's go to the races." And so off I went. And what happens the first time you take someone to the races? Yeah, they hit the, you know, hit a $5,000 quaddie or something, you know. Anyway, Dad came up with more money than he made the previous year.
He had a Midas. Everything he touched seemed to turn to gold for a long time, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, but what happens the next time you go to the races?
Yes, exactly. The sobering reality.
He said for the next 3 years he was broke. You know, and it was a great lesson to him. Yeah. Anyway, you know, he was sensible enough. You know, he realised that your gambling's got to be controlled. And became a builder, met mum, had the kids, had us. Yeah. Then one day with the tiling, I remember earlier than that, he first met Jim Houlihan.
Right. Another great innovator.
Yeah, well, Jim was, 10 years or so older than Dad. Jim was a builder. Dad was actually doing tiling at the Simpson Barracks at Watsonia. You know, Jim had and he sort of kept in touch, on and off with Jim since then, just threw that in just as a racing connection. Yeah, anyway, he was building houses, in the 60s. It was, buy a block of land, he'd design them, build them, and then once they were finished, sell them. That way he didn't have to deal with clients during the construction phase, because he loved to be in control. Then one day, he sold the house and the clients that he sold to wanted a tile floor put on, and he said, I'll arrange that. Yeah, he was promised a date. The company mucked him around and it cost him money and delays, so he said, this is no good. There must be for a company to treat their clients flippantly. Said, surely there must be room in this market for someone that knows what they're doing with regard to customer service. He investigated it, said, there's a big demand. He went to Italy, bought, huge pallets full of machinery, sort of invested all his savings into that, brought it back, rented a factory in Thornbury, set up a company called Marble Floors Proprietary Limited, undercut all the opposition and was just there making money hand over fist.
Yeah, unbelievable, his ability to turn his hand to different things. So Taras Bulber comes around in the mid-70s. He's an owner. When did he first start owning horses? And then post-Taras Bulber, how did that parlay into wanting to train them?
Yeah, well, he kept on having an interest in the races right throughout the 60s. And then in 68, he bought a horse called Celestial Court and trained. He started off with Angus Armanesco, and then Angus was the top of the table around that time. And then Angus said, I don't think he's going to be, what we call a group horse now, a stakes horse, but, I reckon he'll be a nice country horse. And kind of said, recommended Billy Walk to as a trainer. So Billy trained it. They won a 2-year-old maiden at Colac, I remember one day the story was, and he ran a couple of placings in town, got a good offer from Hong Kong, and took the money and then went back to it was after that then he got involved in the tile factory.
Yeah, right. And then we'll go through Taras Bulber. I'm most curious in the transition to training horses. There's a background in being a very crafty, innovative opportunist, but nothing about how to train a racehorse. How did that come about?
Well, with Taras, Dad ended up building the tile factory, so successful and a threat to the big companies. He got an offer, too good to refuse, took the money, and went back to building, and then said, oh, I want to buy another horse. He went to New Zealand with George Hanlon, you know, and another few owners. Yeah, he picked out Taurus Bulba, and George brought it back. Yeah, you know, they came back by ship in those days. I remember when he was due to arrive back, and us all being packed in a car on a Sunday afternoon, driving around the docks looking for this ship that was due to arrive with a horse in a crate.
So did he learn a bit off George? Is that where it started?
Oh, look, you know, Dad's been an incredible, you know, a sponge for knowledge. Yeah, just ask any of the modern day vets, you know, Peter Angus and Glenn Robinson Smith and old Peter Joyce, you know, they'd come here for a 10-minute job and, you know, leave an hour later.
Do you remember when he
virtually, you know, did half a veterinary science degree just by, you know, sort of sucking out the knowledge and things from the professionals.
Do you remember when he first took out his license, success he had with his first horse?
Yeah, well, with Taurus Bulba, he, you know, he had Winx's record, you know, the Australia's highest stakes winner, although, yeah, Winx went a bit higher, and currently the world's one and probably will be for another 10 years, maybe. Anyway, so he was the top of the tree, you know, top weight in the Melbourne Cup and all that. And, I think George was more interested in setting up for the punt than the big races. And, yeah, that Dad and him weren't getting along. You know, Dad always thought, when George had saved back the horse, something would always go wrong. He'd get pocketed or whatever. And then, I remember in the Underwood Stakes, and George just said, oh, look, I'm not real happy with the horse, you know. I'd only have a little bet on him today. Out he comes in the Underwoods. He's all the best horses in the land. He left them four or five lengths behind. Dad was shaking his head. And why'd you do that, George? You know? Yeah, it was one of those things. You know, like, there was a lot of animosity, you know, because Dad struck it, you know, lucky with his first, well, his second horse.
All right, and what was that horse?
And Tommy was, he was a great, you know, marketer, and Tommy would say, Jim, oh, that horse, geez, he did really well up in Sydney, you know, I'll train him for free, you know, I'll just take you my trainer's cut. Yeah, things like that. And, after the last Melbourne Cup, you know, when he's a four-year-old, and, Dad just said, no, enough, and sent him and Taurus Regent up to Sydney, and, next time he comes to Melbourne, and, absolutely dacks Leilani when she was at her top.
Yeah.
And, just went through, you know, all those, the Queen's Plate. He won three. They had a Queen's Plate in Melbourne, the Queen Elizabeth Stakes in Melbourne, then went up to Chipping Norton and a few other in the lead up to the Sydney Cup. Yeah, I remember that was probably one of the big regrets where Langby rode him and gave him the kick 600 out, and he just responded and sort of put four lengths on him coming around the corner at the end of two. He led till the last 10 metres and Upik just got him on the line. And that was just so infuriating. And, you know.
Hey, let's...
That was the thing where Dad was sort of... When you give a horse to a trainer, you're always ceding control to someone else. And Dad always liked to be in control. Yeah.
And sounds like he did it through instinct as much as anything else. I just want to fast track to probably his best horse and the most exciting win, and that was Rancho Ruler winning the Marlboro Cup in 1988. Carlo, let's have a listen to Rancho Ruler for your dad.
Trista Plain, Bianco, Flyer and Planet Ruler still last. On the turn and Rancho Ruler, Harry White said go. And he raced three lengths in front of My Arctic Wolf, followed by Cameronic Impazira getting up on the rails. And further back is Wilbert and Diamond, but Rancho Ruler clear with 100 to go. He's going to be too good. He's three lengths in front under the whip. And Rancho Ruler, a brilliant win in the Marlborough Cup, caused by
I remember that. I was there that day. Bob Hawke was there that day, and I remember he walked past me and said, what a great horse. What was, just in a nutshell, how did your dad train? What was the secret to his training? He wasn't orthodox, but he had this innate instinct.
Yeah, it was as much just to do the minimum amount of work to get them fit enough, you know, because, yeah, they're fragile animals. You can you always used to say half the horses after when they're broken in are ruined, you know. He was great one for saying, look, the less weight on their back, the less chance of getting an injury. So, yeah, he just, you know, always liked to have light track riders. You know, it was a lot easier back 30 or 40 years ago. You know, one thing he did do was we used to swim our horses. You know, he built, the farm that he built.
Yep.
That he bought and developed. You know, we built a huge dam. It was 250 metres of round, so big section at the front where we could go up and back, which was about an 80-metre, you know, round trip, you know, or go right around, which is near 200 metres around, so we could adjust, you know, how long we'd swim. So we used to swim our horses twice a day. You know, so we'll work them in the morning, swim them in the afternoon. So that working them twice a day was pretty
unique. It was very unusual at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, because, you know, so many trainers, you know, they didn't have walking machines in those days. It was, it was a real,
In every way, he was...
advantage, because, yeah.
In every way, he was ahead of the game, wasn't he? Just quickly, because I have to move on. But just his latter years, Carlo, was he happy late in life, Jim?
Oh yeah, well, he just enjoyed all the achievements of us kids, and then his grandchildren. Yeah, they've all been so successful. Yeah, like we got my daughter's doctor, specialist hematologist. My son's an engineer. You know, my brother's, his son's a, his apprentice builder in Canada.
There's something in the DNA there, and I think it's...
She's doing her PhD in mechanical engineering. Youngest daughter's a young businesswoman. She's running, being successful. And the youngest grandchild, she's just started Melbourne Uni studying psychology, so... Yeah, he always says, oh, geez, all the grandchildren are better than the kids.
Well, but that all has to start somewhere, and it probably starts with his old man, but it certainly traces back to your dad, Jim. Carlo, very sad day. I can tell by the tone of your voice that it's really hit hard, and so it should, because he was a legendary, larger-than-life figure. Our condolences go out to you and the rest of the family.
We just so appreciate all the expressions of, joy at having known that, now I'm going to break up. Yeah, thanks everyone.
And thank you for telling us about your legendary dad, Jim Marconi. Thanks, Carlo.
No worries.